Rules to Reality is a podcast that highlights how regulation shapes or fails to shape our daily lives. I'm speaking to you from Wurundjeri country and would like to pay my respects to elders past and present and any Aboriginal or Torres Strait Islander people listening today. I would also like to acknowledge the ongoing role that colonisation and racist regulation has had on First Nations, but also First Nations resilience and survival in continuing to connect and practice the oldest living culture in the world. Today I'm speaking with Emeritus Professor of Law from the University of Sydney Law School, Terry Carney. If you think you have had an original opinion, Terry has probably already written it, and like 20 years ago. Terry has written on and worked in everything: mental health law, child welfare, adult guardianship and administration law, and for the narrow purposes of this episode, social security law. In addition to overseeing the writing of the Social Security Act in 1991, when I was 2 years old, Terry served 40 years as the member for the Social Security Appeals Tribunal and its successor, the Social Services and Child Support Division of the Administrative Appeals Tribunal. Today we spoke about the Online Compliance Intervention Policy, or as you would know it, RoboDebt. I asked Terry how this policy came about, what kinds of logical and legal errors are committed, and what those errors reveal about our public sector, public policy decision-making, and regulatory oversight systems. It's not clear that we're in a better place a year or two away from RoboDebt's collapse, so listen to what Terry says we need to do to reform the system. So please enjoy this episode, subscribe, and rate the podcast on iTunes or Spotify. Alrighty, we'll make a start then. All right, thanks so much, Terry, for joining me today. I'm interested to know from your wide background working in mental health, regulation and governance, law, why do you think regulation matters to the community and why does it matter to you?
Yeah, well, in a way, my interest is broader than regulation as such, in that my main focus is on the gap between what is promised by law or by a government program on the one hand and what it delivers on the other. And they're often at odds with each other. sometimes we deliver little of what is promised or have unintended consequences. So the regulatory portfolio is a wide one for me. So you were mentioning the work I've done over the years one of those projects looked at the role of law in mental health tribunals in setting a boundary, if you like, between around the imposition or not of involuntary detention and or involuntary treatment. And I mean, that's a very important civil rights protective role of regulation in that context. But out of the fieldwork we did, what we discovered is that of even greater importance to people than whether they're detained against their will or not, treated against their will or not, were things like a medication regime and the ability to have an equal dialogue with psychiatrists and medical practitioners about what that medication regime involved. And we also discovered a very, very high interest in, understandably, in whether people had housing, whether they had jobs, what kind of social life they lived. So that's an example of, I guess, the breadth of issues that that interest me in the regulatory space.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. I mean, if I'm right, I remember when I entered as a baby into this space, probably six or so years ago, reading that book. That was that in 2009 or 2013? You released a book on tribunals, didn't you?
Between 2011, yeah.
There you go. Yeah, and it disappoints me that, I mean, most of my experiences in mental health and human rights issues around that, many of the issues that you wrote about in 2011 haven't progressed at all, certainly in Victoria, in the last 10 years. So, I mean, that's a failure of regulatory oversight to some degree, I feel. There's complex dimensions, but yeah, many of the issues that you raise still remain issues. Yeah. Mm. So I know one of the areas, one of the many areas that you've written on is the Commonwealth Government's online compliance intervention policy, or what we generally call robo-debt. So that came into effect in 2016, but some people might not be across what the policy was about or how it came about. Would you be able to explain a bit about that?
Yeah, well, it was an initiative that was foreshadowed in a smaller way around the Christmas before the scheme was attracting any public attention in 2016. And it was a scheme, an idea that was ramped up principally in order to fill a budget black hole that became apparent just before a federal election. So the amount of revenue that was anticipated to be recouped from robo-debt, which really involved a simple expansion of an existing program and the automation of that program. So what was that program? Well, for 20 years or so, Centrelink, in administering the calculation about what amount of benefit a person or pension a person should receive each fortnight, would from time to time match the information that people supplied about their earnings or other income with tax office records. And in just around 7% of those cross-matching of data from the tax office and Centrelink, there would be an apparent discrepancy. I say an apparent discrepancy because the tax office aggregated information over a full year or 6 months, whereas for Centrelink purposes, the rate calculation is a fortnight by fortnight calculation. So unless people had a stable income, and very few people on Centrelink payments have stable, casual or part-time earnings, there would be a significant difference between the 6 months or 12 months, the average from the tax office, and fortnight by fortnight Centrelink calculation. Well, what used to happen in the past in those 7% of the data matches that, you know, appeared to be problematic was that a Centrelink public servant would investigate to see whether the discrepancy was a real discrepancy or not. What the online compliance system did was move from 7% to 100% and take the human being out. That's the long and the short of it. In other words, it assumed that in every one of those data match instances that the average spoke to its constituent parts. Or putting it another way, that that in every one of those cases, those people had a stable source of income fortnight by fortnight over the whole of the 6 or 12 month period, and therefore all of the monies that they'd been paid on some other basis was an overpayment and recoverable without any further inquiry. Mm.
Yeah, and my apologies to the listeners, but the someone has literally just started a blower out the side of my window right now. Maybe that's the Commonwealth government seeking to undermine this podcast. And so, practically speaking, did that overestimate both the amount that any individual likely owed, and then the number of individuals that owed something to Centrelink?
Ah, yeah, dramatically. For some other reasons, apart from just that an average doesn't tell you anything about the components of that average, there is also a kind of an income bank that helps to smooth out from fortnight to fortnight, allows a carry forward of an under claim in a previous fortnight, so that in a later fortnight, when you do have more earnings, you don't get the full penalty reduction amount. You're able to offset with the carry forward of the monies that you didn't claim from the previous fortnight. So yeah, and really quite dramatic. The some debts were, you know, of the order of 20,000, 15,000, $10,000, supposed debts. And when you did the got the information that enabled you to do a fortnight by fortnight calculation, and you get that information by asking an applicant to provide their payslips, or given that most people wouldn't have kept their payslips because they went back a very long way into the early 2010s, the power to require the legislative power that Centrelink has that enables it to compel an employer to provide payslip data to the government. When those proper inquiries were done, these debts of, you know, $10,000 would either drop to zero, and that was about half of them, would prove not to be any debt at all. Or if there was a debt, it would be in the a few hundred dollars. And that few hundred dollars would be due to the sort of slippage or small discrepancy between the fortnight for which a person is paid on the one hand, and the Centrelink fortnightly calculation of rate. If they didn't fully align, then just being a day or two out in the way people were reporting their income would over time build up a small debt, but nothing of the thousands of dollars that often was the case with robo-debt.
And we all, I mean, I certainly got mine reduced from 2,500 to $60, and I know many other people in similar situations.
Yeah.
Ultimately, the policy was found to be unlawful. So, I mean, could you explain why and any other why it was unlawful, and I guess any other reflections that you have on the policy, either legislative or just whether it was good policy or not?
Well, it was obviously very bad policy, but not least because it was unlawful, as you foreshadowed. Why was it unlawful? Because in the case of Social Security overpayments, the law says it's a debt if and only if, and that's what the Parliament wrote, if and only if a section of the Act makes it a debt. That meant that the it was only a debt if you had information for each and every fortnight of the period in question. And by definition, the tax office average didn't supply that. The second reason that it was unlawful is that the full federal court a long time ago had said, and not only must it be proven on a fortnight by fortnight basis under the Act, but the onus of proof, the responsibility for establishing that there's a debt, lies with the Commonwealth, lies with Centrelink. And Robodebt just spat out the average to people and said, you know, here's your $10,000 debt. Prove that it's not a debt. It shifted the onus of proof onto the Centrelink client when it always was a responsibility of the government to prove that.
So is that a common law principle? That's common law. That's not written into the statute, is it? Or?
That was a common law ruling of a full court of the Federal Court of Australia. And the third bit that was part and parcel of it was a ruling of the High Court a very, very long time ago, almost 70 odd or so years ago, that said when you're seeking to prove something that has serious moral and other practical connotations, like you're a debtor, you've done something wrong, and not only are you morally therefore tainted, this is something that credit agencies and even professional admission bodies, a lawyer seeking admission to practice, must address whether they have a Centrelink debt, and if so, the basis of that debt, in order to show that they're fit to to be a practicing solicitor or a barrister. So what the High Court said, 70 or more years ago about those sorts of things is that they're not only is it the Commonwealth's responsibility to prove it, but you need more than just proving it on the balance of probabilities. It's not like finding a person responsible for a crime, proof beyond reasonable doubt, but you need positive, tangible proofs. And of a reasonable credibility. And of course, all that Centrelink was doing in Robodebt was just allowing an inference that because there was a difference between what the tax office said was your average income that employers had paid you over the last 6 to 12 months on the one hand, and on the other hand, what you in each fortnight had been telling Centrelink were your earnings, that the inference was that, there was a debt. This was sufficient proof of that debt. And look, it didn't pass the pub test or anything approaching the pub test of lawyers on any of those counts. They were using the wrong test. They were putting the onus of disproof onto the applicant. And they were applying the wrong standard of proof, an inadequate standard of proof.
And there was, from my understanding, anecdotally, there's been reports of the harm that social policy has caused people who are already in marginalised places, on payments and have no capacity to repay the amount that they were alleged to have taken. And There were questions, if I'm not correct, that it didn't actually generate or raise the money that, probably because it was unlawful and that money wasn't lawfully acquired. But it hasn't been successful, even based on the objective it had. Is that right?
Yeah, correct. In some ways, it was a slow burn revenue raiser or recouping of quote unquote monies that shouldn't ever have been paid out in the past. But the budget papers at different times actually estimated that there would be very significant in ordinary terms outside a COVID crisis amounts of revenue. At the end of the day, it cost $1.8 billion for the government to, once the class action and other litigation told them correctly that it was unlawful and it had to be fixed, that cost at least $1.8 billion. That's on the public record. there may have been additional costs that aren't part and parcel of that rectification figure internal, because about half of all Centrelink staff for about 9 months, some hundreds of people were at work, fully at work, to establish how many of these unlawful debts there were, how much money had been incorrectly raised against people so that it could be repaid. But the forward projections in the federal budget, which go out 3 years from the year of the budget when it's brought down, put the estimates of how much this was going to raise at around the $4 to $5 billion. By the time RoboDebt was stopped in its tracks, something under $1 billion had actually been recovered, about $750 million. And the pressure that public campaigns and the legal litigation had begun to bring to bear had caused Centrelink to have to bring some human beings, more human beings, back into the process of trying to establish whether there were debts or not. And as a consequence, the administrative costs of running the whole program had started to rise significantly. And so it had raised some money for government, but nothing of the order that they had originally hoped for.
So, I mean, colossal policy failure, both in terms of its lawfulness, social consequences, and achieving the stated objectives. Particularly with regards to the question of lawfulness, we have so many checks and balances. Well, we're told we have so many checks and balances in place in Australia to prevent this kind of thing happening. How do you think, and firstly, you know, could you explain what some of those are or ostensibly are, and how this got through that, how this policy got through those checks and balances?
Yeah, sure. I mean, it is really ironic because in the 1970s, before any of these checks and balances were legislated or developed as administrative processes, there was a famous case called Green and Daniels that where really old-fashioned, centuries-old, complicated and difficult to manoeuvre writs were the only way that you could test the lawfulness of an issue like this, and you could only test it in the High Court of Australia. And in the Green and Daniels case, what government had done was just announce a policy that school leavers were no longer going to qualify over the long summer break for unemployment benefits without changing the law. Well,
I enjoyed those. Yeah.
It only took a number of months for the successful old-fashioned crude remedy justice to be obtained in the High Court, declaring that policy was unlawful. By contrast, bringing RoboDebt to heel took 2.5 years or so. And as you say, a whole variety of checks and balances that were designed to, avoid the need to go off to the High Court in the way that happened in Green and Daniels, all failed totally. So what were some of them? Well, the Administrative Appeals Tribunal didn't exist at the time that of Green and Daniels in the 1970s. Why did it fail? Well, it failed because the government quite blatantly, quite deliberately, and by government I mean senior and not so senior people within the department, I'm certain with enough knowledge of government ministers and others of what was happening, the system was gamed. How was it gamed? Well, when you first, there are two levels of appeal in the Administrative Appeals Tribunal in social security matters. And at the first level, hearing is in camera. The public is not admitted, and the decision, although there are written decisions, is not published publicly in the same way that it is if either you being unhappy or the department being unhappy goes to the next level to try to overturn what the first level has done. Well, we know that there were 77 or so from the litigation disclosure cases where full rulings by the first level of the AAT explained that the debt was unlawful and was not able to be recovered. What happened in those 77 cases is that Centrelink just quietly accepted the unlawfulness and expunged the debt, but did nothing to alter the policy. Now, at common law and under administrative instruments, all governments, including the Commonwealth government, purport to subscribe to being a model litigant. What a model litigant should have done after the first few cases was one of two things. Either say, look, we think the AAT is wrong in saying it's unlawful, we want to test this by going up through the system. Or if they weren't prepared to do that, and they did not ever appeal any one of those 77, then they should have revisited their policy to ensure that it was lawful. Now, you know, that didn't happen because the system was able to be gamed. The Ombudsman looked at robo-debt twice. On neither occasion did the Ombudsman ask the law question, at least not publicly. It appears that there were private queries put to Centrelink about the lawfulness of robo-debt. And my understanding is that the answer that the Commonwealth that Centrelink gave was, yes, it's lawful. To my question and your question, well, you know, did the Ombudsman ask to for an elaboration of on what basis it was, lawful, or ask, even better, for a copy of the legal opinion that pronounced its lawfulness? No, they did not. Why did they not do that? Because of what in the policy sense we would say is policy, is regulatory capture.
Could you explain what that is?
it's, I guess, expressed in a paraphrase of apparently what the Ombudsman gave as the reason or its staff for not pursuing the lawfulness of the question. They said, we want to keep our agencies, in this case Services Australia, Centrelink, etc., on side. We want to keep a good working relationship with our department. When that kind of thing comes at the price of your failure to expose and provide for the correction of an unlawful scheme that imposed, somewhere between $1 and $2 billion of non-debts on around 500,000 Centrelink, about 450 whatever thousand Centrelink clients. You've got to ask yourself the question about the morality and appropriateness of that. And, I mean, it demonstrates the reality of regulatory capture and the how harmful. I mean, you know, as academics or, you know, whatever, we just, you know, you can sort of talk about a concept like regulatory capture and you think, oh, yeah, well, you know, that sort of pulls one or two teeth out of the mouth of a few fangs from the mouth of the regulator. But, you know, it's still going to be a pretty effective regulator, surely. You know, we live in Australia. You know, we're not a third world country or whatever. Well, here, it totally negated that key check and balance regulatory function of the ombudsman. I mean, surely if nothing else, they ought to be able to at least expose to public gaze the legality or otherwise, the potential legality or otherwise of a large government program.
And those agencies, you know, and this it really goes back to the first point you raise, or your motivation in doing this work, which is the gap between the law and people's lived experience of the law. You know, that these agencies were put in place to protect the marginalised and provide a far more accessible, low cost, or less administratively burdensome means to protect their rights. But there's just been a bankrupt failure in this situation. I mean, how do you think agencies arrive at? I mean, clearly, if you look, you know, I'm not so familiar with Commonwealth Ombudsman, more a Victorian context, but if you look at their legislative functions, I'm sure it would have logically required them to do the things that you say. How do you think a regulator arrives at that point where they come to value the relationship with the people they're regulating more than the functions that they have?
Look, it's you know, part and parcel, I guess, of moving in the circles of power. You know, everyone is susceptible to not having your antennae you know, raised fully all the time and being sort of alert to the unconscious. In you know, it is principally drift that happens over time as you become, you know, de facto more attuned to, yeah, the big boys and girls of the agencies, and less to the you know, vulnerable ordinary citizen who you probably are not having any human contact with. Yes, you know, the ombudsman gets you know, lots and lots of complaints, but you know, they're in writing. You're talking to people on the phone principally, so the whole lot of those sorts of processes, you know, that account for it. And you know, look, it's not helped by the fact that virtually no lawyer in the country knows anything about social security law, and that was actually exemplified. And so, you know, there would be a question about whether the staff of the ombudsman actually ever looked at the sections of the Act that you know, provide that it's a debt, if and only if the Act says it's a debt, and the provision that says you know, it's a debt if the money you got in that fortnight is you know, was based on an income amount for that fortnight that proved not to be you know, fully accurate. You know, did they look at that? Probably not. Did they? And if they didn't do the research, you know, they wouldn't have known that the standard there for Social Security is superior to that which applies in the ordinary debt context. I mention that because, you know, the other agencies that didn't detect the problem, parliamentary committees, the federal parliament, the closest they got was when, The South Australian Law Society made a submission to the Parliamentary Committee saying, look, in ordinary debt issues, you'd need a bit more proof or a bit better procedure than the one that Robodebt was, running with. Now, the South Australian Law Society likewise didn't know about, didn't look at the provisions of the Act, didn't know about the issue about who bore the onus of proof, and didn't know that it was a higher standard of proof. Well, you can't blame them in a sense, because, as I say, virtually no lawyer in the country learns any part of the law about social security, and there's hardly any business for the legal profession outside the welfare rights centres and a few legal aid contexts. They're not exposed to legislation that runs to around 2,000 or 3,000 pages of printed enactments. I mean, if you're never trained in your undergraduate course, and you don't get any of that kind of work over the course of your professional career, unlike, say, tax, which is of a similar complexity, similar volumes of law in on the statute book, in decisions of tribunals, in decisions of courts. Most lawyers, have at least a smattering of knowledge about tax, but by contrast, hardly anybody knows even the fundamentals of social security. So, in answer to your question, that is part of the reason why these check and balance agencies have failed in this instance.
Yeah, it seems like to me like it's a series of Swiss cheese, pieces of Swiss cheese lined up, and all of the holes needed to be lined up for a policy like this to get through. And I guess I'm wondering, we're what, year and a half, 2 years? COVID time has skewed my brain. But a while ago, we had the judgment finding it's unlawful. I don't know. Do you think we're in a better place to prevent this kind of policy happening again? And, if not, what kinds of things do you think we need to put in place as governments and communities and a legal profession to prevent this happening again?
Look, I think the public service has, if you like, learnt the lesson of Robodebt. There's now, within Services Australia, there's a bit under a dozen new competent, on-the-ball employees, public servants, who are addressing what the processes should be in the future in rolling out, consulting about, refining the use of any artificial intelligence in government administration. I mean, in a way, Robodebt wasn't even proper AI. It was just the mistake of thinking that an apple is an orange, that something about your fortnightly income, the apple, can be, dealt with by looking at what an orange, the 6 month to 12 month average income is about. So, it was just a really fundamentally simple, basic mismatch of data, really. The data wasn't commensurate with the other. When humans made the decision about whether it really was a debt by spending hours using their powers to get the information that was really needed following the sort of suspicion that was raised by the data match, you know, then the system worked well. And so automating, taking the human being out of that process and saying, oh, well, we'll just let the data match generate a debt, you know, it is automation, but it was hardly artificial intelligence or automated decision making in its the form that most government departments are now pursuing. So, yeah, I think that lesson has been learnt. The lesson that hasn't been learnt, I think, is, and we don't really know. I mean, none of us know. We can have all kinds of suspicions about the black box, which is the way robo-debt was developed within the bureaucracy, considered up through the ranks, taken to cabinet, adopted, and then subsequently monitored by ministers and secretaries of departments and so on. The box is not absolutely totally black. There are just little pinpoints of light that shed a little bit of light on the question of that process. For example, there were standard risk assessment protocols that were completed at a low level of the bureaucracy that appear to flag many or at least some of the main concerns that later unfolded with robo-debt. But even those are ambiguous and were being written by more junior and therefore less experienced people. But the whole sort of hollowing out of the public service, you know, causes you to ask whether the public service in its current, hollowed out form any longer has the expertise to be able fully in-house stress test, new policy initiatives on grounds of legality, on grounds of compliance with, ethical administration, on grounds of, assessing potential impacts on vulnerable communities, people who are less technically competent or people who have, don't have the sort of smartphones and other tech that, the majority of the community take for granted. It is starting to be doubtful as to whether that capacity exists or is whether the lesson that it needs to be injected around this small team in Services Australia that I mentioned, whether they alone are going to be capable of ensuring that the next time a policy like this is being contemplated in government, that it's done properly. You'd hope so, but you can't be absolutely confident. And the other part of the black box, I mean, we do know that the two advice teams within Centrelink that considered those 77 rulings, at least, that robo-debt was unlawful, I mean, they're lawyers. So the capacity exists there. It did exist at the time and continues to exist. So there's a question, how come that the advice team, if it concluded either way that yes, the tribunal was correct in, as the courts have later vindicated, in saying it's unlawful, we better do something to tell the services people to redesign the scheme to make it lawful or ask the parliament to pass legislation to give it a legal foundation or something. And if they took the opposite view, why did they not pass that over to the the litigation team to launch a challenge either in the Administrative Appeals Tribunal or in the Federal Court to vindicate their position. The shroud of secrecy has been thrown over that as well. And the questions have been asked by parliamentary committees, but bureaucracy and government has, avoided answering any of those questions. Those are the sorts of areas that have caused people to say we need a Royal Commission to open the black box to the light so that we could see how well or poorly the policy development process and or those processes of how you respond to adverse external rulings of tribunals, how well or poorly those work, so that you could have greater confidence that reforms and changes were made, so that we didn't encounter that sort of thing in the future.
And do you think the Australian Auditor, National Auditor, there were two
Auditor General.
And the Ombudsman, do you think that they've learned lessons from this process? Do you think that if we were to have a repeated policy, get through all of those early checks and balances and still be an issue, that it would be responded to differently by those two oversight agencies?
I'm not sure that it would. And so the question is, well, what are some of the changes that might need to be contemplated in order to provide greater confidence that we wouldn't see this replicated in the future. One of them would be that I think parliamentary oversight committees should, as a routine question of the Ombudsman in relation to its reports, have as a standing sort of question, did you inquire as to the legality of this program? Were there any issues, if they're not there discussed on the face of the report that the Ombudsman has published? With the ability to game the AAT by not appealing adverse decisions, the remedy there requires a balance be struck. It's a very good thing that the vulnerable clientele, particularly in social security, where there are high rates of mental illness and other vulnerability markers, have their hearing conducted in camera. So the remedy there, I think, is that the AAT senior leadership should exercise a power that it already has to publish de-identified, kind of landmark leading decisions. I have absolute confidence in the integrity of senior AAT deputy presidents and presidents and those sorts of processes, that had they been alert to and had there been a history of previous history prior to Robodebt of publishing some of those decisions, I've got no doubt that that would have been done. I handed down what appears to be the country's first invalidation, it was one where the department was put on full notice of the kinds of issues that I thought were in play about the legality or illegality of Robodebt. They provided written submissions that failed to engage at all because, it was indefensible, and their written submissions, I'm afraid, made that pretty transparent, as did the fact that they declined my invitation to appear before me and provide oral argument and discussion.
I would have found that intimidating too, though, Terry, to be fair.
And, you know, look, had my decision been published, or one of the others, other excellent decisions that other members gave, you know, the flaw, you know, however it arose, you know, as the class judgment said, you know, Justice Murphy, when it's a choice between a stuff up and a conspiracy, you know, go for the stuff up every time. And basically that's what, you know, in November last year, in settling the class action, and the reasons for that the judge gave for you know, accepting the settlement, that's there on the face of the reasons, you know, you know, stuff happens, bad stuff happens, you know, and really you can't ever, you know, no administration, no individual is anything like perfect, you know, and we can make really egregious, you know, after the event, really stupid looking, incompetent, you know, whatever, how could you possibly have thought that? The trick is, you know, and that's what the whole accountability machinery and regulatory machinery is about, is early detection and correction of those kinds of egregious or not so egregious mistakes. And so the real concern about RoboDebt is that it was able to be kept on foot for, you know, whatever it was, two or so years beyond when it really ought to have been sorted out.
it was an open lie for a long time, and like you say, it is. Everybody was quite aware, and I think there were quite a few cases that couldn't get up at various points in time for the gaming reasons that you spoke about, and a lot of lives were destroyed in that time as well, or people placed in marginalized or vulnerable situations because of that.
I mean, the class action that I was referring to was, you know, November last year, and the second of the two Victoria Legal Aid individual challenges was 12 months before that. That was the second of two challenges. The first one fell over at the last minute because, arguably, again, it was gamed. You know, as it was about to come on for hearing, the Commonwealth exercised a power to expunge the debt in question in the first of the federal court challenges. They could have done the same with the one, you know, November before last as well. And they only chose not to do it because while they agreed that there was no debt, they didn't want to pay interest on the money that the person, the litigant, you know, had lost during the time that the debt amount had been held by the Commonwealth rather than by the false debtor, you know, who would have spent or otherwise, you know, gained interest or whatever on the money. And so it was a fortuitous in a way that because of a concern about really the pin money aspect of pin money side of robo debt, that the Commonwealth dug in its heels and said, "Oh no, we'll allow this one to, you know, proceed." And then, of course, when I say they allowed it to proceed, when it came the day before it was the first hearing was scheduled, the Commonwealth totally folded its tent and settled, conceded everything, knowing, of course, that it didn't have any legal leg that could possibly defend the case that, you know, had been, those two cases had been brewing for just on a year.
I guess it is, you're making a compelling case there for a Royal Commission, because there's just this long line of failures that lead to a scenario like that. And it is, you know, like you say, some things have been learnt and changed, but a lot of the same underlying conditions aren't addressed, and probably ones that we don't know that are in that black box. You've given the listeners a really rich understanding of, I guess, the social policy failures, the regulatory policy failures in robo-debt. What's one thing that you want them to do after listening to you here today?
Well, I think they should principally add their voice to a Royal Commission or some other systemic inquiry, because I guess the bottom line, message from me is that it's a failure of governance, a failure of the quality of governance in the development of new policy initiatives. That's where the where I point the finger, and I think it's largely one without fault. It's, I believe, a byproduct of stripping over two or three decades what was and still is a good public service by international standards of so many of its top brains and people, leaving it at a point where no matter how well it tries or how well government ministers in seeking to oversight development of policy, it leads to bad, inadequate, very flawed policy, just because there are too few people with the capacity to think through all of the elements of it. And if I'm right in believing that through no fault of its own, robo-debt is a byproduct of the fact that small government and the economic efficiency dividends that they have to keep paying, so that each year you have to do things with fewer and fewer public servants on your books. If that's the fault, it's about time we got to the heart of it all and rethought either funding the public service more fully, or thinking through if the public service is not capable of doing this policy development, well, what other processes are we going to have policy sort of co-designed? Now, there are all kinds of reasons why that might be a good thing, co-designed not so much with the private sector, KPMGs and so on, who do so much of that work now. And, there's a very wide array of very senior public servants and others, former politicians, who are saying too much of the program and policy development is outsourced now to these private consultancies. Why is it being outsourced? Well, because as the FODI report, the government's own report into the public service said, it's because we're understaffed and underskilled, and we no longer have the capacities to do our job. The only way we can deliver good policy is by contracting it out to private consultants. So not so much those partnerships, but co-design says, well, if you're thinking of improving the way debts are raised in Social Security, How about you co-design, work with welfare rights centres, legal aid commissions, and actual social security clients to find out, you know, how things really work in the overpayments and debt recovery space. And, you know, on the basis of that broad consultation, think about, you know, what programs or changes or need to be developed. But, yeah, it's really fundamental stuff about the degrading of the capacity of the Commonwealth Public Service that I'm most concerned about. And I would think, I mean, it's an odd thing to ask people listening to this program to be pushing for. It sounds much easier to press for a Royal Commission or, you know, something sexy like that. Actually, I think it's, you know, the nuts and bolts kind of stuff about how we've allowed government to be denuded, to become an almost an empty shell that needs thought and attention.
Yeah. Thank you so much, Terry. I appreciate your time today, and I know the listeners will too.
Thank you.